From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Sound there of rescue operations in Guatemala, which continue today after the Fuego volcano erupted over the weekend. 3,200 have been forced to evacuate. At least 69 people have died. And we're seeing horrifying images of the scene. Here's reporter Mark Stevenson of the Associated Press.
Several of the stunning images are the myriad ways in which people died in this eruption. Some were burned to death when buildings were set aflame by fast-moving flows of lava, clouds of ash, and then the most terrible thing is that the ash mixed with water and sent flows of what appeared to be steaming mud down the river valleys and down the creeks.
Ash even reached as far as the capital, Guatemala City, 25 miles away from the volcano. Rudiger Escobar Wolf is a volcanologist at Michigan Technological University. He's a native of Guatemala and joins us on Skype. Rudiger, welcome. And first, just tell us about Fuego. This is what's called a bellwether volcano.
Well, Fuego is a very typical stratovolcano that has a lot of frequent eruptions. It has been active since there are written records since the Spanish colonial occupation of Guatemala, and it has continued to the present. So it has been erupting continuously since 1999. And in the last few years, since about 2015, it has had about a large eruption per month. So it has had a very high level of activity, and that's also partly contributing to this tragedy.
But when was the last time it had a major eruption, or one that is like the one we're seeing now?
Probably in October 1974. That was probably an eruption of comparable size to what we saw yesterday.
Is this volcano different than the one that we've seen erupting in Hawaii?
Yeah, it is very different. Hawaiian volcanoes, and this particular case, Kilauea, usually produces lava flows. In this eruption at Kilauea, there were also some explosive events and ash, but it mainly produces lava flows. It produces some ash, but it very rarely, at least from what we know, produces this kind of pyroclastic flows, which is the deadly phenomenon that caused all the deaths.
Were there any warnings for Fuego? We know that in Hawaii, they were having earthquakes, a lot of earthquakes, right before the volcano started erupting.
It's complicated at Fuego because, as I mentioned before, there are very frequent eruptions. So they knew one of these eruptions was starting, but to some extent, it has become like a normal thing. So certainly they were not expecting a pyroclastic flow this large that would directly hit the community. So initially when it started, it looked like any other of the frequent eruptions. So they were aware that the activity was rising, and the observatories sent out special bulletins documenting that the activity was high and telling the civil protection and the communities and other authorities to be on the watch. And basically, partially was what happened was that the activity got to the deadly lethal pyroclastic flows too quickly for most of them to react. Some places had evacuated, but this particular village that was destroyed, where most of the casualties happened, they apparently did not evacuate, and that was the cause of so much deaths and destruction.
And what about the ash? We said that it's reached Guatemala City. That's 25 miles away. Is that uncommon? Does it pose any risk to the people living there?
Comparatively to the pyroclastic flows, the ash is just a nuisance. It's not a good thing. But the main problem here, the main impact, was due to the pyroclastic flows. And yeah, it is regularly more or less common to get ash fall in Guatemala City. Every 5, 10 years or 20 years, you get some ash from a volcano. So it's not unheard of.
Are we likely to see more explosions from this volcano?
It seems that the activity has decreased. The agency, the monitoring agency in Sivume, which is the equivalent to the USGS in the US, has announced that the eruption basically had finished and the activity was at a low level. But I'm sure they're keeping a close eye on the activity because it could increase again. And almost certainly in the next weeks, months, we will see another episode of activity. But as I mentioned previously, of maybe 20, 30 episodes that have happened over the last 2, 3, 4 years, none of them had produced such a large pyroclastic flow. So we may see another eruption, another increase in activity, but hopefully we won't see another of this deadly pyroclastic flows happening.
That's Rudiger Escobar-Wolf, who's a volcanologist at Michigan Technological University and a native of Guatemala. Rudiger, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you very much.
Well, now to the disturbing pictures out of Thailand that went viral. We have a video at herenow.org. You see a huge pilot whale, first beached and dying in a canal, red umbrellas to protect him from the sun, buoys to hold him up so he won't drown. Then he's on an operating table surrounded by the pounds of plastic garbage bags that killed him. More than 300 endangered sea turtles and over 100 whales and dolphins die just on Thailand's beaches every year, victims of ingested or strangling plastic. But it seemed all of Thailand watched as veterinarians tried to save the male pilot whale for nearly a week. He died last Friday, and activists are seizing on the anger there to move Thailand toward taxing the companies that make plastic bags or the consumers who've used them since they were introduced by the petroleum industry just decades ago in the 1950s. Enrique Sala is an explorer in residence and marine ecologist with National Geographic. He studies ocean plastics. And Enrique, we spoke to you last year about Henderson Island. That's a remote island in the Pacific, discovered completely covered with plastic. What were your thoughts when you heard about this latest animal death?
I was so sad. I had seen this before in the Mediterranean in Greece, a sperm whale 20 years ago, dead on a beach. My friends did an autopsy and found many, many, many plastic bags, yeah, like a hardened ball. And when I saw the photos of this poor pilot whale in Asia, I couldn't but cry. You know, it's just we are creating the horrible dystopian future that nobody wanted.
Well, remind us why. I mean, we've said the number so many times that it's numbing. The journal Science found that 8 million metric tons of plastic make their way into the ocean every year. But how else can you describe how bad it is?
Well, there is an easier way to understand. Every minute is the equivalent of a garbage truck full of plastic going into the ocean every minute. Mm.
And of course, no, the sea animals are ingesting it and then they can't function and they slowly die. Look, you've got recycling, but we understand the global recycling systems are gridlocked because, first of all, there's so much. People put the wrong things in bins, so it stops up the recycling centers. China, which takes much of the world's recycling, much from the U.S., has been refusing much of it because it's tainted. It's not clean enough. But has recycling plastic bags, which has been more recent, has that helped at all?
The problem is so huge that little actions here and there are not enough. The problem is so huge, but the solution is easy. You know, we can stop plastic from getting into the ocean, and this has to happen at different levels. At the top level, governments have to prohibit the production of toxic plastic single-use items like plastic bags, straws. There are many countries and cities around the world that have already done that, and it works. You know, Corsica prohibited plastic bags in stores and supermarkets 25 years ago, and the rivers, the little rivers of Corsica, don't have any plastic. You know, and then the consumers also have to say no to plastic bags, single-use water bottles, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, as you say, there's been movement on that. Just last week, the EU proposed a ban on plastic bags. Researchers in Thailand are seizing on this moment of anger in that country to call for a ban there as well. Do you think that's really going to happen, banning plastic bags completely?
Plastic bags is not a big industry. You know, the plastic is started as a byproduct of the oil industry, the petrochemical conglomerate. Right? There are many plastic products that are big industries, but plastic bags are not. This is very small part of our economy, yet every year people use trillions of plastic bags around the world, and all this plastic ends up killing 1 million seabirds and 100,000 marine mammals, like that one pilot whale we see in Thailand. Yeah. The problem is that most of these animals die without nobody knowing.
You know, there's a lot of activism around this, but even just if you go to your supermarket, instead of taking those 10 little plastic bags for a couple peppers and a cucumber, You just, you know, put them right in your own bag. I mean, it's amazing how many plastic bags you can use in a day.
You're absolutely right. You know, before plastic bags, these flimsy plastic bags were available, everybody had their own canvas bag. My grandma and my mom went to the market in Spain without plastic bags. They had their own traditional bags. And this is something that is easy to solve. We have got too comfortable with all these things like plastic straws that we don't need.
And we were saying that this whale on the beach in Thailand, it has become the at least viral video equivalent of that poor sea turtle that had a plastic straw up his nose a few weeks ago, just bringing it home to people what plastics are doing. Enrique Sala, explorer in residence and marine ecologist with National Geographic, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Robin.
It's primary day in a number of states today, including the most populous state, California. And there's a lot at stake there with a race for governor, Senate, and some key House seats. Joining us now for a preview is Marisa Lagos, political reporter at KQED in San Francisco. Hi, Marisa.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
Well, thanks for being here. And I guess we should start with the governor's race. The primary system in California is nonpartisan, which means that the top two vote getters in the primary, regardless of party, are going to head into a runoff in the general election in November. And it sounds like those top two vote getters might well be the Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, the former mayor of San Francisco.
Look, California is a movement. California, I believe, are a cause. And the world is looking to us not only to live together and advance together and prosper together across every conceivable difference, but also looking to California to lead, not just nationally, but internationally. And that's what I intend to do as your next governor.
And former L.A. Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa.
I intend to make it absolutely clear that California is going to mark a different path. We're going to embrace the diversity of this state. We're going to welcome our newcomers. We're going to say that our health care is a right, not a privilege, that our environmental laws ought to lead the nation and the world.
Is that a sure thing? Is there anybody else who might beat them?
So that felt like a sure thing maybe 6 months ago, just because in California, Republicans have less than a quarter of the registered voters. They've actually fallen behind no party preference or independent voters. But in the last month or so, we've had businessman John Cox, an Illinois native who moved to San Diego a couple years ago.
I'm a businessman. I'm not a politician. We can certainly demonize other people, but what we've got to do is we've got to sit down and we've got to focus on solving problems. That's what a businessman does. That's what I've done for 40 years.
Cox really kind of surging in the polls. He actually benefited from an endorsement from President Trump a couple of weeks back. And so given that, you know, it is a primary and there's a lot of people on the ticket, it's likely that the Democrats will split their vote among Newsom and Villaraigosa and the other bigger name Democrats, and that Cox might slip into the runoff.
So there might actually be a Republican facing a Democrat in the fall.
Yes, a very old school of us. And it's interesting because, as you mentioned, this top two system has been in effect for a couple of election cycles, but this is the first time we've really seen it played out in the governor's race.
Well, whoever wins is going to be taking over, if they win in November, will be taking over for the current governor, Jerry Brown, who is retiring. He's the state's longest serving governor. He was elected twice in the 1970s and then again in 2010 and 2014. He's been somewhat of a thorn in President Trump's side and an agenda setter for Democrats across the country, especially on the issue of climate change. How do the front runners compare to Brown?
You know, Gavin Newsom, who is sort of the favorite in this race, is definitely positioned himself to the left of Jerry Brown. You know, he's very famous for in 2004 as mayor of San Francisco opening up City Hall to gay marriage,
right,
and kind of starting that train. And he's talked about his support for single payer, universal preschool. Antonio Villaraigosa has positioned himself more centrist. I think he's really tried to seize on what he sees as an opening there. But the bottom line is, you know, Jerry Brown came into office in the midst of the recession. We had a $27 billion budget deficit in California. He's really credited for, you know, in some ways saving the state. I mean, at that point, there had been IOUs issued because the state couldn't pay its bills under Arnold Schwarzenegger at one point. So I think whoever takes over next is going to have to sort of live in the shadow of Jerry Brown and the things he's done. Especially given that if it is indeed Cox and Newsom in the November election, it's pretty much guaranteed that Newsom will win just because of the numbers in terms of Democrats and independents who lean Democratic, but is going to get challenged a lot more than Jerry Brown did by his own party, because there's a lot of Democrats in the legislature that have wanted to spend a lot more money than Jerry Brown's been willing to in recent years. And so I think it'll be interesting to see kind of the dynamics. There's not a lot of people like Jerry Brown in politics.
Now, Jerry Brown is from Oakland. Gavin Newsom, as we said, the former mayor of San Francisco, Villaraigosa, former mayor of L.A. Is there a Northern California, Southern California dynamic, or who has the power in the politics in the state?
Yeah. So the interesting thing about California is that Los Angeles is like basically 60% of everything if you look at population. Mm-hmm. But they don't really exercise that power at the ballot box. And that's because we have such a higher turnout rate in the Bay Area, in Northern California, than often we see in Southern California. And I think that's something that's hurting someone like Villaraigosa, who, you know, in a state like this, you cannot do the retail politics that are so famous at, say, the beginning of the presidential campaigns in places like Iowa. You have to be on TV. You have to raise money. And so I think that Newsom has had an advantage there, both because he's an elected statewide official currently, while Villaraigosa has been out of the mayor's office for several years, but also because you have this couching of the political system and the power structure with a lot of the money and the turnout being in the Bay Area. And so I think we're seeing some of those old Dodgers versus Giants rivalries play out in this race.
Another politician who is facing election this year, also, by the way, from Northern California these days, is Senator Dianne Feinstein, who is seeking a sixth term. She is a very powerful Democrat in Washington, but she is 84 years old, and there have been a lot of Democrats pushing for new leadership. What kind of competition does she have?
So she's being challenged by Kevin DeLeon, who is a state senator. He was the president of the state Senate until recently, and he has been running very much to her left and I think has pushed her on issues, including her new support for marijuana, her opposition to the death penalty. You know, it remains to be seen if he'll make it into the November election. Because DeLeon's really struggled with fundraising. And again, that same issue of sort of getting your name out there in a state this big and this expensive. But it does feel like Feinstein's been feeling at least a little bit of the heat, although the polls are, you know, looking a lot better for her than for him.
Another incumbent fighting to keep his longtime seat is Republican Representative Dana Rohrabacher of Orange County. He's an ally of President Trump. How much of a shot do Democrats have at picking up his seat?
Well, I might phrase it differently, which is how much of a shot does he have at keeping his seat? Mm-hmm. It may be Democrats, but this is one of those districts, like a couple in that kind of region of Orange County, San Diego, southern Los Angeles, where we're seeing this whole open primary, this top two, really become an interesting problem for both parties. So in that seat, Rohrabacher is actually being challenged by a man named Scott Baugh, who actually worked for him at one point. The concerned Democrats have a couple of pretty strong candidates, but there's so many people on the ballot there, they're worried that Rohrabacher and Baugh could actually shut them out of this runoff. And so, you know, Rohrabacher is an interesting guy. He is pretty libertarian on issues like marijuana, but he's also tied himself to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks and had some, you know, interesting questions around Russia ties and his backing of Trump on some of those things. So he is vulnerable, but the question is, can Democrats sort of overcome the party registration advantage that Republicans have there and keep that, or, you know, and flip that seat blue? I'm not sure they're going to be able to do it.
And what about Daryl Issa's seat?
So, yeah, Issa is one of two incumbents down there who decided to skip running for re-election after a very tough battle. He only won by about 1,600 votes in 2016. That's, I think, a really interesting district because it shows how Orange County, which has always been the stronghold for Republicans, mm-hmm. is really changing with the immigration influx of both Asian American and Latinos. Second generation are tending to be a little bit more liberal, and it's becoming younger. And so, again, that's a seat where I think Democrats have a pretty good chance if they can, you know, make it into the runoff, if they can actually get somebody there and not split the vote among so many Democrats mm-hmm. that Republicans squeak through.
And by the way, the other retiring Republican you're talking about down in Orange County is Ed Royce, who decided not to seek election this year. So what's the turnout like in a primary election in California?
Not great. You know, primaries in general in the state have favored more conservative. It tends to be a wider, more conservative turnout. We usually see more sort of progressive and diverse energy in November. I think that's one thing everyone's kind of watching when we talk about this potential blue wave. There's been a lot of debate here, for example, over whether Latinos will turn out. They have historically had pretty dismal under 20% turnout. I think some people were hoping that would change, but I think we'll probably see, you know, under 40% of the electorate come out.
So you say that one other race that we should talk about today is the race for the next state superintendent to oversee California's public schools.
That's right. And this has come down to a battle we've seen actually play out in the governor's race among two Democrats as well, which is a question over kind of school reform and charter schools. Marshall Tuck, who has run unsuccessfully for this office before, is being backed by charter schools. He's a big reform advocate. Tony Thurman, a state assemblyman from the Bay Area, is running with the support of the California Teachers Association and other very powerful unions. And it's become sort of this proxy battle in this bigger debate that we see playing out really nationally over education and what's the best thing for students. It's just fascinating. There's so much money being spent in this race for a position that honestly isn't all that powerful. In California, most of the actual decisions over, say, whether to allow a charter school to open happen at the local school district level. So one of those ones that I think might have some voters scratching their heads as to why they're hearing so much about it. But when there's money around, you know, there's going to be fights.
That's Marisa Lagos, who is a political reporter at KQED in San Francisco, talking to us as California voters go to the polls today on primary day. Marisa, thank you.
My pleasure, Jeremy.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
For years, hours of videotaped interviews with survivors of the Holocaust sat packed away in a closet in Brookline, Massachusetts. A filmmaker recently rescued the old tapes, weaving the dozens of interviews together into a living memorial for survivors. Connecticut Public Radio's Patrick Scahill has this story.
Harvey Brovman says he knew the Holocaust tapes would change his life, and that scared him.
I was afraid of what I might hear. I was afraid I couldn't do it.
Brovman is the director and producer of the film Soul Witness, the Brookline Holocaust Witness Project.
These people went through great pains to tell these stories, and most of them had never told these stories to even their own family members.
Brovman is talking about dozens of hours of interviews recorded in the 1990s with Holocaust survivors living in Brookline. The original idea was to edit the interviews down, but for the town, it was a big and expensive task. Some of the raw recordings were sent to an archive at Yale University. Others went into storage, where they sat for over 20 years, until Lloyd Gelinu, Brookline's chief diversity officer, started going through the old stockpile. He soon learned the tapes were interviews with Holocaust survivors.
And I'm like, oh my God, this has been sitting in my closet. Why haven't we done anything with it?
So Gelinu got in touch with Brovman, who cleaned the tapes up, digitized them, and eventually spent hours watching and editing the interviews. The stories are gut-wrenching, like Rena Chernoff's, a survivor of Auschwitz who recalls the last time her mother and brother spoke. She says the Nazis were choosing numbers for people who they would kill.
My mother asked my brother, did they take down your number? And my brother didn't answer at all. And he was 9 years old at the time. And he just threw his piece of bread that he got to my mother over the fence, and he said, you take it. I won't need it anymore.
Cheryl Lefman's father, Henry, is also in the film. Lefman says she watched some of his Holocaust testimony years ago when Henry taped his interview, but she couldn't get through it.
It tore my heart apart.
In this interview, Henry Lefman recalls a final conversation with his father shortly before he was murdered.
Remember, my son, you must live. You must survive. You must survive. And I'll be with you. I'll be with you.
Cheryl Lefman's father did survive, emigrating to Massachusetts and eventually becoming an engineer. Lefman says for her father, the Brookline interviews fulfilled that final father-son promise.
That he would live to tell the story of what happened in the Holocaust as well as to their family. So I think he would be tremendously proud.
Filmmaker Harvey Brothman says the hours of interviews reveal survivors detailing not just a historical legacy, but an emotional one.
They wanted us to know about the people they lost. They wanted us to know that they loved them and that they don't know why they were the only ones that survived. It's still hard to talk about.
But survivors did talk about it, some telling their stories near the end of their lives. Building a living memorial, Brothman hopes will preserve these voices for years to come. For Here and Now, I'm Patrick Scahill.
Patty Hirsch has spent years covering Wall Street as an analyst and a journalist. He's now editor of NPR's Planet Money Indicator. So perhaps it's not surprising that Wall Street is the subject of his new novel. Not today's Wall Street, but Wall Street in the year 1799, in a New York City that is just emerging as a financial center for the brand new United States. The book is called The Devil's Half Mile, and Patty Hirsch joins us now from New York. Patty, it's great to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Jeremy.
And by the way, you and I know each other very well because we were working together at Marketplace. You were my editor at Marketplace when I was covering Wall Street. But we'll talk about that later because we'll first talk about your book. Why Wall Street in the 1700s?
Well, I wrote a book a bunch of years ago called Man vs. Markets, which was an explainer of the financial markets. And I wanted to write a follow-up to it, which was really talking about how markets are created. And I wanted to write a book about the creation of the New York Stock Exchange. So I started, you know, doing a lot of research and doing a little bit of writing. And then I realized that it was really all research and reading letters by Alexander Hamilton, Aaron Burr, and all these types of people. And, you know, going to the New York Library and paging through dusty tomes. Hmm. And it just became so dull that I kind of, just to keep my hand in on the writing side, I wrote a little bit of a murder mystery into the narrative. And that kind of sidebar project really just took over the whole thing and ate it all up. And now the nonfiction project is in a dusty drawer somewhere. And you know, here we are with a fiction project instead.
How difficult was it to figure out what things were like on Wall Street in the 1700s?
Actually, relatively easy. I mean, once you'd got over the hump of getting into the library and really sort of going through all of those books and those archives, there's actually quite a lot of documented material out there. There's a lot of painting, which is great, and a lot of letters and sort of historical accounts that talk about what life was like back then. And of course, the history of the New York Stock Exchange itself, with this Buttonwood Agreement that was signed in 1792 on May the 17th, when you had 24 people got together under a Buttonwood tree to sort of create the origins of the New York Stock Exchange, that's been very well documented. So there's a lot of information out there. You've got to go hunting a little bit, but it's all there.
Well, and you mentioned that some of it was boring as you were looking through it, but then you threw in a murder mystery into the book. Yeah. I mean, it reminded me of the fact that, you know, when you cover business news, when you cover financial news, you do have to find ways to make it a little more interesting or it will be very dry.
That's right. And if you're looking back, you know, however many hundred years, because you can't speak to a person. Anyway, when we do financial and economics reporting now, we can speak to a person to ask them how they're affected by something. Of course, we can't do that now. So you've got to find personalities who existed, you know, in 1792 and those or 1799 in the case of my book. And those people, of course, don't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. So you can't tell those stories. So I felt it was kind of easier to make one up and sort of tell the story that way.
Well, and your main character is Justice or Justy, who has been away from New York for a few years. His family is Irish. People can obviously hear your accent. I will tell them that you're actually from Northern Ireland, not the Republic of Ireland. But but he's Irish and went to Ireland to train as a lawyer. And at the beginning of the book, he returns to New York. Were there a lot of Irish immigrants working on Wall Street at that time?
Working on Wall Street? No. Working in New York? Yes. Because although you hadn't had the huge waves of Irish immigration that you saw in the 1850s and 60s because of the famine, you still had a lot of Irish that had come across, attracted to America so that they could escape the oppression of the British in Ireland because they were brutally oppressed. And they came to New York and they found that they really just exchanged one oppression for another, because although the oppression was no longer physical and they weren't essentially indentured servants or essentially slaves as they were in Ireland, when they arrived in New York, they found they were absolutely second-class citizens because they were Catholics. They were discriminated against strongly by the Anglican-type Protestants in New York. And because they were Irish, they were kind of regarded as subhuman by the English, who still dominated New York society then, even after the Revolutionary War.
In your book, you refer to the financial panic that took place in 1792. What happened there and how did it compare to maybe what we saw in 2008?
Well, there are a lot of similarities. I mean, what happened was in 1792, Alexander Hamilton had created what he called the Bank of the United States, what was called the Bank of the United States, which was in a way the first kind of government bank. Mm-hmm. And in order to make that bank popular, in order to sell its shares, he created this interesting system where you had to buy some of the shares in cash and then you had to use government bonds to buy the shares. So it's this weird system. But what it essentially did is it juiced the market for government bonds, which is what Hamilton wanted to do. And this one speculator called William Duer, whose name appears in the book, mm-hmm. and is kind of a central character, if not actually alive at the time, he tried to corner the market in these government securities and leveraged himself up like crazy, borrowed money from everybody in order to do that. Unfortunately, the market and those bonds collapsed. I wouldn't say collapsed, like he dropped about 20%, but that was enough to put him out of business and make him bankrupt. And when that happened, he made a lot of other people very, very nervous. A lot of people sort of were not able to, you know, redeem their loans. There was a run on the Bank of the United States, also a run on the Bank of New York. And credit dried up not just in those two banks, but in all the regional banks as well. Does any of this sound familiar?
Yeah,
it was
right.
It was a lot like 2008. So you had a relatively small bank that actually had some problems that squeezed the entire banking industry. And Alexander Hamilton had to step in and actually do a number of things to create liquidity and shore up confidence in those banks. And he essentially created the first bailout. So there are a lot of similarities between 1792 and 2008.
Well, so does it make you think that everything that goes on Wall Street is cyclical and it just will keep happening over and over again, that even when we learn our lessons, we forget them?
It absolutely will, especially, and you look at the process of deregulation that we're going through right now. Well, I mean, and I think some of that deregulation is appropriate. I mean, Dodd-Frank was originally supposed to be, I think, 170 pages, and in the end was 2,300. Mm-hmm. So clearly that's a massively bloated bill, but they may go too far. And the generation of bankers that are getting into the chair now and will be there for the next 10 years, they won't remember what happened in 2008. So they're almost destined, almost doomed to make the same mistakes.
I don't want to give too much away, but there's a Ponzi scheme in your novel, which makes me think of the time that you and I were covering the Bernie Madoff situation in New York. He ran one of the largest Ponzi schemes in history and eventually went to jail for it. What made you want to put a Ponzi scheme into this book?
Well, I think it's, you know, the problem is there were no rules on Wall Street then. There was no regulation. Everything was, it was all self-regulation. And in fact, in the wake of the panic of 1792, Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson had a conversation about whether or not they should actually put a framework of regulations around the burgeoning securities business. And they decided no. We're going to have self-regulation instead. And if you think of the context when America had just thrown off the shackles of the British government, it didn't want to have all of these rules and regulations. It wanted people to be free. It wanted self-determination. People could be responsible to look after themselves. And that's the argument that they made for not putting this framework around the securities markets. So come 1799, it's like, what rules were they that could be broken? Well, there really were no rules that could be broken. Pretty much anything was fair game. But cheating in a way that the Ponzi scheme cheated people, I think, was just so outrageous that it kind of stood out as if not a breaking the law, certainly breaking the spirit of the law. So that's why I use it. And also, frankly, a Ponzi scheme is relatively easy to understand, whereas, you know, complex, you know, financial securities and, you know, all the malarkey that goes on with those, that's tough to explain.
Well, maybe 300 years from now, somebody will write a book about credit default swaps with a murder mystery thrown in to spice it up a little.
My God, that's going to be exciting.
Yeah, right.
I can't wait.
So back to us, Patty, and you and I, as we said, we used to work together. You remember that?
I remember it very well. In fact, I remember one night, I think you called me at about 11:30 at night or something, and I was at a party somewhere. It was a Sunday night. And I think it was the news of AIG going down had just broken, and you were on the morning report the next day. And you were locked out of the office, as I recall. I think you were. It was raining, and you were sheltering under the awning of the Citibank building. And you said, "You know, can you brief me on how this AIG thing works? Because I haven't got internet access. I need to understand it." And I remember laying it out for you, and it was. I was very impressed because you synthesized it in such an interesting way. And the next morning, you were on the air at 3:30 or whatever it was, and you were able to just take that very very complicated story, synthesize it and spit it out in a really, really simple way that everybody could understand. And I think that's what you and I as journalists, and in a way what I'm trying to do as a novelist, that's what we're about.
It's funny that you say that because I have told that story before too, but in a slightly different way. This is the way that I tell it. I say,
I wasn't drunk.
I called up my editor. I said, so AIG is failing. Do you want me to do this for tomorrow? And you said yes. And then I said, okay, just a quick question. What is AIG? So I guess we figured it out in the end. That's Patty Hirsch, whose new book is The Devil's Half Mile. Patty is a financial journalist. He's been working with NPR and Marketplace and is the editor of the Planet Money Indicator. Patty, great to talk to you. Thank you.
Jeremy, thanks for having me.
Apple is continuing its annual Worldwide Developers Conference today. So far, the company has struck a tone different than some expected. Yes, revealing some features to help manage time spent on its devices, but no broad apologies like the ones we've seen from Facebook and others. So for more, let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Kurt Wagner is a senior editor at Recode. Kurt, talk more about the broad message that Apple's sending out.
Well, unlike a Facebook or a Google, Apple is not an advertising business, so they have this really great opportunity right now to try and differentiate themselves from a lot of the other companies that are out there apologizing and really actually took a few swipes at the Facebooks and Googles of the world saying, hey, you don't need to worry about, data privacy with us. In fact, we're going to roll out features to help you handle that kind of sharing with other companies and even limit the amount of time you spend using those other apps. That's a benefit that Apple has right now because of the business it runs.
Well, and just go a little further. I mean, Apple really doesn't care, and others have pointed it out. Apple doesn't care how much you use their iPhone. They just want you to buy their iPhone, whereas Google and others are dependent on you constantly using their services because that's how they make money, because of the advertising they sell.
Exactly. And so Apple came out with this interesting product yesterday called Screen Time, which users are going to be able to look at their phone and see how much time am I spending using certain apps or certain services, and then actually set limits to how much they want to use those. So if you feel that you are addicted to Instagram or using it too much, you can set a limit on your phone. Hey, I only want to use it this amount of time per day. That's a terrible thing for Facebook, right?
Yeah.
The Facebook doesn't want you to use less time on Instagram. But in Apple's case, it's okay. As long as you see that as a useful feature, that's a win for Apple. Well, so that's why they're coming out with this kind of stuff.
Well, especially since parents will potentially use that screen time to place limits on how much their kids are on Instagram, which is, getting extraordinary. But I'm wondering if some are going to see this, Apple offering this as, it's like a drug dealer offering you some Narcan, to go. Because they also say, and we have all these other great bells and whistles that we want to show you that will make you use the apps more.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they came out and said, hey, we have these new augmented reality features. You're going to be able to, transform your face so that you either look like a cool cartoon version of yourself or maybe even look like a dinosaur or something like that. And you can have conversations with people in that kind of physical form. They came out with group FaceTime. So you and up to, I believe, 32 people can all be on the same FaceTime call together. So it's not as if they're saying, hey, use our phones as little as possible. I mean, they're certainly coming out with things where they want people to use the phone. But those are Apple products.
Well, and what about sharing data? Facebook, let's talk about that for a second. They have gotten into a lot of trouble about how they handle privacy. In April, there was, of course, that political research company, Cambridge Analytica. It turned out they'd gotten a hold of data from Facebook. Then over the weekend, the New York Times reported Facebook had allowed dozens of hardware manufacturers, including Apple, to access personal user data. What more do we know about that? And what has Facebook said in response?
So Facebook has come out and said, hey, these are partnerships, right? So before Facebook had mobile apps, before you could go to the App Store, the Google Play Store, and download the Facebook app, they still wanted Facebook to work on smartphones. So they started partnering with all of the different smartphone makers, including folks like an Apple, as you mentioned, or even, you know, BlackBerry, Nokia, companies like that, so that there were ways for you to kind of replicate the Facebook experience on a mobile phone. But obviously, in order for Facebook to work on a Nokia phone, Nokia has to be able to have access to you and your personal data, which includes data about your friends, because those are the people you're interacting with. And so how do we know that these phone makers, the Apples of the world, used that data that they had access to responsibly? And Facebook has said, hey, there has been, you know, no misuse of that data. But again, this is at the very beginning of this. So we're kind of yet to figure out exactly if this is a problem or if this is just something we weren't really familiar with. Yeah.
Going back to the addiction issue and Apple, the investment firm Jana Partners and the California State Teachers Retirement System recently sent an open letter to Apple saying, please research the health effects of your products, particularly on children. Do you ever see, you know, a real reckoning over this, over what these devices are doing, especially to children?
I think there's a lot of people that are starting to have more thoughtful discussions around the role of technology, and especially among kids, because it's not at all uncommon for parents to, you know, throw on YouTube and pop the kids in front of the iPad for a couple of hours. It's a great babysitter, right? But the only way that these companies are really going to change is if people actually change their behavior or force them to act by maybe not buying a phone or spending less time. And as of right now, as far as I can tell, no one is being punished in that way. You know, Facebook is not being punished because people are still using Facebook, and Apple's not being punished because people are still buying the iPhone. So until people start kind of voting with their dollar, I don't see this as being a top, top priority for these companies, although I do think all of them want to come across as being thoughtful and responsible in this way. So we're going to hear more about this. I'm just not sure how dramatic of an impact it's actually going to have.
In the meantime, Apple has screen time. Kurt Wagner, senior editor at Recode, thank you.
Thank you.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.